together. Lest I forget before the end of the class, next week, but 2 weeks from today, we start into chapter 17, and that's another chapter to which we're devoting two classes. So the first class, 2 weeks from today, is sections 1 and 2, and the second class, contrary to what's in your schedule, is not also sections 1 and 2. That's a different schedule. Another mistake in that schedule, but the rest of the chapter, whatever that is, 3 and following for chapter 17. So sections 1 and 2, 2 weeks from today, and then the rest of it the following week. Okay, here's what I'm going to do with these notes on chapter 16. We're going to take this, I'll just tell you as we go along. The chapter 16 then treats a series of questions raised by the six metaphysical elements. These questions are not at anywhere near, for the most part, as engaging personally and existentially as the material on limitation and transcendence and so on that we've just covered. He's not offering in the book a full metaphysics, but he's attempting to show the power of the method that he's proposing in a few areas. So I'm only going to select the particular emphases, and particularly with the things that I'm cutting out even from these notes that are most significant for the remainder of the book. So number two there, the first item that he treats is the notion of distinction. The only thing that we really need to get out of that is to only know that something is different from something else, or somebody's different from someone else, by a judgment, not by looking, not at any prior level. It's as simple as that, the point that he's trying to make. That knowledge of any distinction is reached only in judgment. In the negative comparative judgment, this is not that. Any P and Q are distinct if it is true that P and Q, that P is not Q. If it is true. Not if they look different. That's not the way you know that. If it is true. If the evidence is such as to sustain the judgment that it, one is not the other. That's the only thing that solves if you wish. All I wanted to cover was his emphasis that distinction is known in judgment, in the negative comparative judgment. A is not B, I am not you, and so on and so forth. The second topic, number 5, on the notes here is relations. And here too, I'm only going to cover the first point here. Because a lot of the other stuff that he goes into, while it becomes important in Trinitarian theology, can be covered when you get to Trinitarian theology. The whole development on the theory of relations is very important, obviously, in Trinitarian theology. But here, and he's not into Trinitarian theology yet here, so his only point, or his principal point, is that the relative component of any concrete relation, so take, for instance, quantitative proportion, is inseparable from its base. I'll read this and then just give an example. It's inseparable from the base in the conjugate form which it implicitly defines. And the secondary components, for example, the variable non-systematic determinations, such as twice, are also explained by the metaphysical elements. The reality of any real relation is not distinct from the reality of its base. It is not something added on as yet another metaphysical element. Rather, the whole structure of proportionate being is itself relational. So relation is not something in addition to potency form act. The whole structure is relational. Now, what he means when he says the relative component of any concrete relation is inseparable from its base. If you take just, there are a lot of relations that are much more interesting than the relations of quantitative proportion, but because that's the example that he's using here, I'll stay with it. It could be said perhaps that at one point in our lives, my height was 3 times that of my nephew. All right, and at another point, my height was twice that of my nephew. Both of those statements would have been true at different times without any change in my height. So a change in the determination of the relation does not necessarily mean a change in both of the terms of the relation. In this case, there was only one term that had to change. I didn't have to change so that my height became twice, and previously had been 3 times. A change can take place in a relation without a change in one of the terms of the relation, and yet it's totally relational. When you've got a quantitative entity like height, it's always going to be in some kind of proportion to every other material being that has the same quantitative mixture to it. So that we could go around and measuring the proportions of our heights in this room, and that you'd have different relations. Okay, not that that would be a particularly fruitful activity to do, but there are. It's inseparable from the base in the conjugate form. The relationality is in the conjugate form. In this case, in the proportion, the quantity, whatever it might happen to be, there is relationality in that. And the secondary component is the variable non-systematic determination. That at this point in my life and his life, I was three times his, my height was three times his, and another point it was twice. That's non-systematic development of his own growth and development and so on and so forth. But that's also explained by the metaphysical elements. Okay, we saw it, genetic method explains organic growth. You can explain it through potency form act. All right. That's all that he's really trying to say in the whole section on relations here, and I want to skip the rest of it because it's just, it's not that interesting for the rest of the book, and it's not necessary. Again, you can read these notes, and I presume that you have read or will read again the section on relations. But what I want to do with these notes is go over to page 3 and to number 13, and this is more important. I want to take this completely because this is key to the remainder of the book. The section is called The Nature of the Metaphysical Elements, but really what he's at in this section is the intelligibility of being and the intelligibility of the real. And that there's nothing more important for as the book proceeds than the affirmation that the real is completely intelligible, because that's the issue on which the whole argument for the existence of God will hang when we get to chapter 19. So the question, and he starts it out with in number 13 here, with the question of the nature of the metaphysical elements. What are they? What are potency, form, and act? They don't possess any real what is it of their own, such as what is a human being, but rather they express the structure in which one knows what proportion of being is, because they express the objective correlative to the operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging. So the mold in which our understanding of proportion of being will flow is a mold that is a content of experience, a content of understanding, and a content of judgment. A content of experience is potency, a content of understanding is form, a content of judgment is act. So they are expressing that structure in which the knowledge of being will unfold. They regard proportion of being not as understood, but only as to be understood. And the corollary here, which is very important, and is something that even the philosophy, the Thomist philosophers who taught me in St. Louis in the early 1960s, they didn't have this yet. If you want to know what forms are, you're not going to find it out from metaphysics. You won't find it from philosophy. You've got to turn to the sciences. It's the sciences that tell you what the forms are. It's the sciences that tell you what the intelligibility of the physical universe, the chemical universe, the biological universe, the psychological universe, the human universe, what those intelligibilities are just discovered by scientific inquiry. Philosophy just tells you there is form. That's all it tells you. It doesn't tell you what it is. Metaphysics works out for scientists not what the forms are, but the dynamic structure of their inquiries, the dynamic structure of the universe they seek to know. Cognitional theory and metaphysics work on a second level, at a second remove, to work out the general structure of the contents of other results. So just as the metaphysician should not try to say just what various forms are, so the scientist should grasp the limitations of his or her competence. That the scientist may have to turn to cognitional theory and metaphysics to work out the general structure of the universe. This is an issue that maybe for many of you would not be germane, but when we were taught philosophy according to the Gilsonian method of Thomist thinking back in the 1960s, philosophy was the real knowledge, and science was constructural. Philosophy was that told us what things really were, And we basically knew that by taking a good look at them. And the sciences would construct knowledge as if there was something wrong about that. All knowledge is constructed, okay? And that's one of the things that Lonergan is saying. If intelligence is part of knowing, then you've got a problem. Because the issue is, when do I know whether what I've constructed is true or not? But I construct hypotheses, I construct theory, I construct intelligibility, and then I have to verify it. So there isn't such a thing as a human knowing that doesn't involve some construction on the part of the mind. That doesn't make him an idealist. If the construction can be verified, then he's not an idealist, or a relativist, or a subjectivist. But all human knowing involves some constructive activity. What is it? Well, let's try this. That's a constructive activity. Let's try it and see if it holds up. The mind is constructing a hypothesis. all knowing, and in ordinary everyday living too. You know, you try to say, what's going on in a given community? You know, well, let's see. Let's I wonder if this is the issue, or what's going on in the presidential race in the United States at the present time. Well, the pundits and the journalists and the analysts, they're constructing scenarios that may or may not hold up. It's all construction. And the issue is, are the insights correct? But insight itself is constructed. It's a construct. The mind constructs, and that does not make us idealists or subjectivists or relativists or anything like that. Okay, but there's been in contemporary Thomism, this is the big battle between the so-called transcendental Thomists, where they throw Lonergan into that, even though there's a lot that's very different in Lonergan from Rahner and Marechal. There is a lot that is similar as well, because they've got the mind constructing things, you know, and you know, we can't go that way. Well, the mind, sorry, it does. And it's doing it all the time. The issue is verifying the constructions. Next then, are the metaphysical elements cognitional or real? Potency, form, act. Are they the structure in which proportion of being is known? Or are they the structure immanent in the reality of proportion of being itself? This is a big question for the remainder of the book. Okay. Are they notionally or really distinct? If they're just products of the mind, then they're notionally distinct. If they're not, if this is the way reality is structured, then they're really distinct. Potency, form, and act are really distinct. The real issue is what I've got in bold here. What is the relation between knowing and reality? All right, this is big for the remainder of the book. Begin by affirming the intrinsic intelligibility of being. Being now as the objective of the desire to know. Being has been defined as what is to be known by understanding correctly. Being is known completely when there are no further questions to be answered. If we ever reached that point, and we would reach it only if we could see God, this is a theological conclusion to that, where there are no further questions to be answered, we would know being completely. Only on the counterposition is intelligibility said to be extrinsic to being. All right, so we begin then with being is what is to be known by understanding correctly. That means being is intelligible, if that definition is correct. Next, recognize that intelligibility is of different kinds. Formal intelligibility is known in as much as one is understanding. Formal intelligibility is the content of insight. Potential intelligibility belongs to the materials for inquiry, which the idea unifies and relates. So when I come upon something new and I ask, what is this? I'm already assuming a potential intelligibility to these materials. The question itself is based on the assumption that it can be answered. And it can only be answered if there is some intelligibility to these materials. So I'm assuming, rightly or wrongly, but at least I'm assuming a potential intelligibility whenever I ask the question, what is this? What's going on? How do I get to the bottom of this? Actual intelligibility is known in as much as one grasps the virtually unconditioned. In other words, in as much as what you affirm, what you construct in insight is verified through the process that leads to judgment. These differences of intelligibility are also intrinsic to being. This will come up even more acutely when we reach the problem of evil in chapter 20. That even evil situations are potentially intelligible. Potentially intelligible because out of them good can be drawn. And this is obviously only under religious inspiration could those affirmations be made. But these differences, and it's even hard there, when you see what we are capable of doing to one another, when you see 9/11 and Auschwitz and so on. These differences of intelligibility are intrinsic to being. Proportionate being is what is to be known by experience, understanding, and judgment. It is a compound of three distinct kinds of intelligibility: potential, formal, and actual. So potency, form, and act assign not merely the structure in which being is known, but also the structure immanent in the very reality of proportionate being. Again, to just put it up here this way, but we've got that chart that I had earlier. There's the knowing. There's the known. There's experience, understanding, judging. There's the content of experience, which we call potency. And that's individuality, continuity, succession, coincidental departures from systematic schemes, and so on. There's the content of understanding, which is form. And that's either central form, the unity of a thing, for instance, the I, the human being, or conjugate form, properties, accidental, Aristotle would have called accidents, and so on and so forth. And judgment, the content of judgment is act, either existence or occurrence. Now, by the definition of being, as the objective of the pure desire to know, being is the known. So potency, form, and act are intrinsic to not only being as known, but being. Because being is the known. Being is what is known in true judgment. So potency, form, and act are components of what is being. Now there's one further step. Is that what the real is? Is being the real? Or is the real something other than being? Okay, and that's the next step. And that comes into, well, let me finish number 15, but then I add this on in number 16. Potency, form, and act assign not merely the structure in which being is known, but also the structure immanent in the very reality of proportionate being. Moreover, because there are conjugate and central formal intelligibilities, there are conjugate and central potency, form, and act. Well, I did that with that diagram. In fact, now we may say, now this is an intimate marriage that he's talking about now, between knowing and being. Now we may say that our knowledge begins with presentations, mounts to inquiry, understanding, and formulation, and ends with critical reflection and judgment because its proportionate object is constituted by combining different types of intelligibility. Why do we know the way we know? Because the object is formed that way. That's a very realist statement in philosophy. That is not an idealist statement. And anybody that would ever want to accuse Watergate of idealism has got to read that statement. It's not that being is what it is because of our minds, it's that our minds are what they are because they know being. And being is constructed in this particular way. The same material can be put, and this is my own, now 15 is taking what Lonergan says in chapter 16, and in number 16 here I'm doing it, putting it in my own words. The argument here is important. It's a sustained argument, but we've got it. It's important to get it. Okay. Number one, being is what is to be known by understanding correctly. And so being is known completely when there are no further questions to be asked or answered, or it would be known if there were no further questions. The materials for inquiry, then, are potentially intelligible. And if they weren't, there wouldn't be any point to asking questions. But we continue to ask questions. So we continue to keep this faith, that philosophical faith, if you want, that they are potentially intelligible. Understanding will yield a formal intelligibility. Affirmation of that formal intelligibility, where being is known, yields an actual intelligibility. If proportionate being is what is to be known by experience, understanding, and judgment, then proportionate being is constituted by potential formal and actual intelligibility. The unfolding through individuality, continuity, succession, coincidental departures, and so on, potential intelligibility coming into form through unities and conjugates, existing and occurring. Potential formal action. So, potency, form, and act are the structure immanent in proportion to being. Potency is potency for form, act is act of form. In fact, our knowledge begins with presentations, again, the same thing that he said, mounts to inquiry, understanding, and formulation, ends with critical reflection and judgment, precisely because what it's after is constructed in that way, is constituted by combining potency, form, and act, potential, formal, and actual intelligibility. Or again, another argument for the same thing, for the intelligibility of being, if you accept that being is the objective of the pure desire to know, what is known by intelligent grasp and critical reflection, what is known by the totality of true judgments, then you have already committed yourself, at least implicitly, to the imminent and complete intelligibility of being. And then there's the leap. If the real is being, the real isn't something else, the real isn't what appears, the real isn't what we can't see, the real isn't only what we do see. The real is being. The real is what is known in true judgments. Then the real reality is completely intelligible, even if we don't understand it now. If we are already committing ourselves to the affirmation of the complete intelligibility. Questions on that argument? If you got it, it's an important argument because it will be part, well, anticipating it will be central in his philosophical argument for God's existence. I'm going to skip 17 to 20 on the metaphysical equivalence because it's just for us to find the examples of it that would be relevant to our work here is not all that important. Danny Mansour has made a great thing out of these rules for metaphysical equivalence in one of his papers, but it's so far down the line in terms of where we're at in terms of what we're trying to get at this point, and I'm just going to skip that part. So I want to come to number 21, the question of the unity of proportionate being. And what I want to do, I've only got 10 minutes, and so I'm going to skip to number 25, the unity of the human person, to make sure that we can cover that material. The rest of it we can look at. This is the transcendental one, all right, that we're talking about. Being transcendentals, being true, good. Von Balthasar's new emphasis of reinstituting the beautiful as transcendental, I think he's right on that. And one is, these are the what the medievals emphasized as the transcendental, the transcendentals of being. Okay? And they're all identical, being, true, good, beautiful, one. Right? Right? What he's dealing here with here is the unity, is unity, or the transcendental one. And what I'm concerned about is the unity of the human person. What does it mean to say a human person is one, is a unity identity whole? We are one, yet both material and spiritual, and that's the difficulty. We are one, and yet we are both body and spirit. And how do you affirm that without a duality? We are one. We're individual by central potency, one in nature by central form, existing by central act, each one of us. From the physical through the chemical, the biological and psychological to the intellectual, otherwise coincidental manifolds of lower conjugate acts are rendered systematic by conjugate forms on a higher level. That happens in us, in our organic development, our psychic development, and our intellectual development. But while intellectual conjugate forms are the higher system of sensitive living, all right, what does that mean? It means that by my insights, by my judgments, and by my decisions, I bring organization to my sensitive life. How do I get my act together? All right, you don't get your act together just by going with the flow of the processes and rhythms of bodily nature. You get your act together by understanding who you are, making judgments about what you should be doing, and value judgments and decisions. So the higher conjugate forms of intellectual habits organize sensitive living, and that's that point there. So while intellectual conjugate forms are the higher system of sensitive living, they can be so both unreflectively through grounding the patterns of sensitive experience and reflectively. So we can do this more or less reflectively. Socrates' whole thing about the unexamined life is not worth living is that it's more important to do this reflectively. By grasping the intelligible systems relevant not only to sensitive living but also to the universe, and attaining knowledge of ourselves within our knowledge of the universe, and willing the execution of our function in that universe. Again, there's that universal openness. So to be authentically what we are meant to be in this entire cosmos and universe of being. So this duality of control gives rise to the contrast between the intelligible and the intelligent. Intelligibility that is not intelligent. This is his definition of matter. Intelligibility that isn't intelligent is material. Intelligibility that is also intelligent is spiritual. That's what is meant by spirit. Spirit is intelligibility that is also intelligent. Matter is intelligibility that is not intelligent. We've already established, and we hope to have established, that all reality is intelligent. Now that intelligibility is being divided into intelligibility that is not intelligent and intelligibility that is. Intelligibility that is also intelligent is spiritual, and intelligibility that is not intelligent is matter. In us, it would be something like this. There would be a physical, chemical, biological, psychological, intellectual, moral, religious schemes of recurrence interacting with one another, having an effect on each other. Right in here is a transition from experiencing through questioning to insight, and then to judgment, and then to moral deliberation, and so on. From this point on, from the emergence of the question, we're talking about spirit in the human person. This is material. The linking point is the psychic, which is the experience and the images and the feelings, the tripartite constitution of the human person, body, organism, psyche, spirit. But spirit emerges with the question. by this definition of the spiritual. Intelligibility that is also intelligent. Spirit emerges with the question. The question for understanding. The question for insight. So we are a combination, and as far as we know, we are the only beings in this universe. We know there may be on other planets and in other systems and so on and so forth, other beings that are put together this way. Spirit, psyche, organism, material, and the psychic, which is a link. The psyche shares in the schemes of recurrence of the body and of the spirit, so that we feel the tension. We feel the urgency of a question. That's the psyche participating in the life of the spirit. But we also feel the tiredness of the body. And we say, I'll pursue that question, but not now. I'm too tired. We feel it. The psyche participates in the schemes of recurrence that are physical, chemical, biological. And the psyche participates in the schemes of recurrence that are intellectual, moral, and religious. And it does that through empirical consciousness, through feeling, through emotion, through image, and so on. So that's so intelligibility that is not intelligent is material. Intelligibility that is also intelligent is spirit. And those are both in us. Inasmuch as we are material, we're constituted by otherwise coincidental manifolds of conjugate acts that are spontaneously reduced, assisted by higher forms. But inasmuch as we're spiritual, from this point on, we're oriented outward to the universe of being. We know ourselves within that universe, and we guide our living by that knowledge. So it's not that we just wait for some kind of spontaneous other form to integrate us. We are guiding our living by our knowledge of who we are in the universe. That's descriptive. To move to explanation, if you'll give me a minute here. Besides the correspondence between the material intelligibility that is understood and the spiritual intelligibility that is understanding, there's a difference. And it lies in the fact that spiritual intelligibility abstracts from and so is apart from the empirical residue. While material intelligibility, all of these, are not without the empirical residue. The metaphysical equivalent of the empirical residue is prime potency, and the empirical residue is the ground of materiality, so prime potency is also prime matter. Matter is what does not and cannot occur or exist apart from the empirical residue, what is constituted by or conditioned intrinsically by the empirical residue. Conjugate potencies, forms, and acts on the physical, chemical, organic, and psychic levels are material. And since central forms are differentiated by their conjugates, the corresponding central forms of atoms, chemical compounds, plants, and animals are material, as are the corresponding central acts. But the spiritual is neither constituted nor conditioned intrinsically by the empirical residue, not constituted by it, insofar as we are understanding, we're abstracting from the empirical residue. Insofar as we're judging, we're attaining something that is not the brute factualness of touching this thing, but rather perhaps finding in this evidence for a judgment. There's a big difference between bumping into it and finding that this is evidence for a judgment. Two very different things. Not conditioned intrinsically, the conditioning is extrinsic. Since understanding abstracts from the empirical residue and reflective understanding grasps the unconditioned in the conditioned fulfillment and so on. What I want to do is simply emphasize it. I'm past time, so I'm not going to go into this, but he's arguing here for the possibility of the continuing existence beyond the death of the material body, the continuing existence of the central form of the human being, the I, that is constituted by the spiritual conjugates. So his argument is for the possibility of the continuing existence beyond the death of the body, of the I that is the central form of the human being. We'll come back to that and start the next class with that, because it's a very big point, obviously. Is there a life beyond death? It's a rather big point. That's the issue that he's discussing at this point. But we are past time. So thank you for your attention. We have material. We can ponder that during meeting.